86. No fisher of men. In the twilight, a long black Zim passed through the wide-open guardhouse gates, accelerated around the asphalted bends of the Morfino Institute's yard, cleared of snow by Spiridon's broad shovel, and black again after the thaw, rounded Yakonov's Pobieda, and pulled up sharply before the Institute's stone portals. The Major General's adjutant bounded out of the front seat and briskly opened the rear door. Pudgy Fomo Askolupov, in a blue-grey overcoat too tight for him and a general's astrakhan hat, braced himself, waited for the adjutant to fling wide the outer and inner doors of the Institute, and made his way upstairs. He looked preoccupied. Behind the antique standard lamps on the first landing, a space had been partitioned off to serve as a cloakroom. The woman in charge hurried out, as if to take the general's overcoat, though she knew very well that he would not surrender it. He did not, nor did he remove his hat, but went on up one flight of the divided stairway. Prisoners and female free workers using the stairs vanished in a hurry. The general in the astrakhan hat did his best to preserve his dignity while ascending with the haste that the circumstances demanded. The adjutant left his own coat in the cloakroom and caught up.
"Find Reutmann," the general said over his shoulder. "Warn him that I will be with the new group in half an hour, expecting results."
On the third floor he did not head for Yakonov's office, but went in the opposite direction, toward number 7. The duty officer caught sight of his back and glued himself to the phone, trying to locate Yakonov and warn him. Number 7 was in a state of collapse. It didn't take an expert, which Askolupov certainly was not, to realize that nothing was working, that all the systems rigged up after months and months of trial and error had been torn down, wrenched apart, wrecked. The wedding of the clipper to the scrambler had begun with the dismantling of the bridal pair, panel by panel, block by block, almost condenser by condenser. There was smoke in the air from soldering irons and cigarettes. A hand drill buzzed. Men were arguing over their work. Mamurin was yelling hysterically into his telephone. In spite of the smoke and din, two men noticed the Major General's arrival. Lyubimichov and Siromacha always kept half a wary eye on the entrance. They were not separate persons, but indefatigable, self-immolating mates, unswervingly loyal, eager to serve, ready to work 24 hours a day and give ear to all the weighty thoughts of authority. When Number 7's engineers conferred, Lyubimichov and Siromacha joined in as equals. They had, in fact, learned a good deal in the hustle and bustle of Number 7. When they spotted Askolupov, they put their soldering irons down in a hurry. Siromacha rushed to warn Mamurin, who was on his feet shouting into the telephone, while Lyubimichov, out of the goodness of his heart, seized his boss's easy chair and hurried on tiptoes toward the general, looking for instructions where to put it. In another man this might have seemed like toadying, but in lofty, broad-shouldered Lyubimichov, with his amiably ingenuous look, it was the homage of youth to an esteemed elderly person. Setting the chair down and shielding it from everyone except Askolupov, Lyubimichov flicked imaginary dust from the seat, observed only by the Major General, and stepped briskly to one side. There he and Siromacha stood stock still, in eager anticipation of questions and instructions. Askolupov sat down. He kept his tall fur hat on, but undid one button of his overcoat. The laboratory was suddenly silent. The drill stopped whirring. Cigarettes went out. Voices were hushed. All that could be heard was Bobinin, still in his den, booming instructions to the electricians, and Priantchikov, lost to reason, still wandering around the wreckage of his scrambler with a hot soldering iron in his hand. The others looked on and waited for their superior to speak. Mopping his brow after his difficult telephone conversation, arguing with the head of the engineering workshops, they had bashed the prefab panels too hard. Mamurin approached and exhaustedly greeted his former workmate, now elevated to heights that he himself would never reach. Askolupov extended three fingers. Mamurin had become so pale and wan that it seemed a crime to allow a man in such a state out of bed. The blows of the last 24 hours, the minister's anger and the shattered clipper, had hit him harder than his high-ranking colleagues. The muscles under his skin were wire-drawn. If a man's bones can lose weight, Mamurin's had. For more than a year he had lived for the Clipper, believed that the Clipper, like the little humpbacked horse in the fable, would carry him to safety. No attempt to gloss over the disaster, not even Priantchikov's arrival under Number 7's roof with his scrambler, could conceal the catastrophe from him. Askalupov knew how to direct an operation without understanding it. He had learned long ago that all you need do is provoke an argument between knowledgeable subordinates. That was what he did now. He frowned at them and said, "Well, then, how's it going?" compelling his subordinates to speak out. It was the beginning of a pointless, boring discussion that merely interrupted their work. They spoke reluctantly, sighing, and whenever two of them started speaking at once, both gave way. The two keynotes of this discussion were "we must" and "it's difficult." The "must" theme was developed by the frenzied Markushov, supported by Lyubimichov and Siromacha. Short, pimply, energetic Markushov spent day and night feverishly devising ways of distinguishing himself and earning remission of sentence. He had suggested combining the Clipper and the Scrambler, not because as an engineer he was sure that it would work out, but because Bobinin and Priantchikov would become less and he himself more important. Much as he disliked working for love, with no hope of enjoying the fruits of his work, he now felt indignant with his despondent colleagues. For Askalupov's benefit, he hinted that the engineers were not pulling their weight. He was only human, one of that widely disseminated breed that creates oppressors in its own likeness. Grief for the past and faith in the future were written all over Lyubimichov's and Siromacha's faces. Mamurin lowered his translucent, yellowish face into his fleshless hands and, for the first time since he had been in command of Number 7, remained silent. Khorobrov could scarcely conceal the malicious glint in his eyes. He was overjoyed to be witnessing the burial of 2 years of endeavour by the Ministry of State Security. He had always been readier than any of them to contradict Markushov and exaggerate difficulties. Askalupov, for some reason, was particularly critical of Dursin, accusing him of lack of enthusiasm. When Dursin was agitated or hurt by unfairness, his voice almost failed him. Because of this handicap, he was always found guilty. Yakonov came in while they were talking, and out of politeness contributed to a discussion that made no sense in Askalupov's presence. Then he called Markushov over and balanced a scrap of paper on his knee, so that they could hastily sketch an alternative scheme. Askalupov would have liked more than anything to tear into them and bawl them out. He had perfected his technique to the finest nuances of intonation during his years in authority. This was what he was best at. But he saw that right now it would not be helpful. Askalupov may have felt that his conference was getting nowhere, or he may have suddenly felt like a change of air before his fateful month of grace ended. Whatever the reason, he rose while Bulatov was still talking, made for the exit, looking grim, and left the whole staff of Number 7 to agonize over the predicament in which their slackness had landed the head of the Department of Special Technology. Protocol compelled Yakonov to rise with his superior and carry his fleshy bulk after the Astrakhan hat, which just reached to Yakonov's shoulder. They walked along the hallway in silence, but now side by side. The departmental director did not like his chief engineer walking beside him. Yakonov was taller by a head, and a towering head at that. It was now Yakonov's duty, and it could even be to his advantage, to tell the Major General about the amazing, unexpected success with the encoder. Ever since Abakumov's late-night reception, Askalupov had glared at him like a maddened bull. This good news would clear the air. Only, the drawing was not in his hands. Sologdin's remarkable self-possession, his convincing show of readiness to go to his death rather than surrender the drawing gratis, had persuaded Yakonov to keep his word. He would bypass Askalupov and report to Selivanovsky that night. Askalupov would be furious, but he would have to calm down quickly. Moreover, seeing Askolupov so downcast, so fearful for his future, Yakonov enjoyed leaving him to agonize for a few days longer. The engineer in Yakonov felt a sort of painful concern for the project, as though he had devised it himself, and, just as Sologdin had foreseen, Askolupov would inevitably muscle in and claim co-authorship. The moment he heard the news, without so much as a glance at the drawing, he would move Sologdin to a separate room and try to keep out those who should be helping him. He would send for Sologdin, browbeat him, set impossible completion duties, call up every other hour from the ministry to hurry Yakonov along. And he would end with the vainglorious conviction that only his close supervision had set the encoder on the right lines. All this was so sickeningly obvious that Yakonov was happy to say nothing for the moment. Once in his office, he did, however, help Askolupov off with his overcoat, something he would never have done with others present.
"What's your Gerasimovich doing?"
Askolupov asked, sitting down on Yakonov's armchair without even removing his hat. Yakonov sank onto a visitor's chair.
"Gerasimovich? You mean when did he get back from Spiridonovka?" "In October, I think it was. Since then he's been working on a television set for Comrade Stalin. The one with a bronze plate reading, 'To Great Stalin from the Czechists.' Call him in."
Yakonov made the call. Spiridonovka was another of the Moscow special prisons. Just recently, a very clever and useful gadget had been produced there under Engineer Babur's supervision, an attachment to an ordinary local telephone. What was particularly clever about the device was that it worked precisely when the telephone was not working. As long as the receiver was reposing in its cradle, everything said in the room could be monitored by the security service's control point. The device found favor and was put into production. When a suitable subscriber was identified, his line was cut, and the victim himself called in a repairman who pretended to be mending the phone and bugged it. The forward thinking of the authorities must always be thinking ahead, was now focused on other gadgets. An orderly looked in at the door.
"The prisoner, Gerasimovich."
"Send him in," said Yakonov.
He was sitting on a small chair, exiled from his desk, numb, and in danger of toppling over to right or left. Gerasimovich came in, catching his foot on the strip of carpet as he adjusted his pince-nez. Confronted with these two heavyweights, he looked smaller and narrower in the shoulders than ever.
"You sent for me," he said,
moving forward and looking between Askolupov and Yakonov at the wall beyond.
"Uh-huh,"
Askolupov replied.
"Sit down."
Gerasimovich sat. He took up only half a chair.
Let's see.
Askolupov searched his memory.
"You're an optician, aren't you, Gerasimovich? More of an eye man than an ear man, right?"
"Yes."
"And you,
he rolled his tongue as if licking his teeth clean,
"seem to be well thought of."
He paused. Screwing up one eye, he looked hard at Gerasimovich with the other.
"Do you know Babur's work?"
"I've heard about it."
"Uh-huh. And you've heard that we've recommended Babur for early release?"
"I didn't know that."
"Well, now you do. How long have you got left?"
3 years."
"That long?"
Askolupov sounded surprised, as if all his prisoners were in for just a month or two.
"Dear me, that is a long time."
He had recently cheered up one newcomer by telling him that 10 years was
a flea bite. Some men are inside for 25. "I dare say you wouldn't mind earning remission yourself."
A strange coincidence, Gerasimovich thought, so soon after Natasha's plea yesterday. He steeled himself. He never allowed himself to smile or make any concession when talking to the bosses.
"How would I get it? You don't find it lying around in the hallway?"
Askolupov rocked back in his chair.
"Television sets won't get you remission, of course. But what if I transfer you to Spiridonovka in a day or two, and put you in charge of a project? You can get it done in 6 months and be home this autumn."
"What sort of work, if I may ask?"
"We've got lots of work lined up there. You can take your pick.
Here's one idea. Planting microphones in park benches. People jabber away regardless in those places. It's amazing what you hear. But maybe that's not in your line.
No, that isn't in my line.
But we've got something for you, too, I'm sure. Two jobs, both important, both urgent. And both right up your alley. Am I right, Anton Nikolaevich?
Yakonov nodded confirmation.
One is a night camera using those, what do you call them, ultra-red rays. So you can photograph a man at night in the street, see who he's with, and he'll never know till his dying day. They've produced rough drafts abroad. All that's needed is creative copying, and making the apparatus simpler to handle. Our agents aren't as clever as you. The second thing is small potatoes, but we need it urgently. A simple camera, but so tiny it can be fitted into a doorpost, so that as soon as the door opens, it will photograph whoever goes in or out, in the daytime or with electric lights on. Never mind in the dark, that doesn't matter. This is another little gadget we would like to put into production. What do you say? Will you take it on?
Gerasimovich's pinched face was turned toward the window. He did not look at the Major General. The word doleful was not in Askolupov's vocabulary, so he could not have defined the fixed expression on the prisoner's face. He had no wish to. He was waiting for a reply.
Natasha's prayer had been heard. In his mind's eye, Ilarion saw her bloodless face, her eyes glassy with unshed tears. For the first time in all those years, going home was a possibility within his grasp. His heart was aglow. All he had to do was what Babur had done. Make room behind the wire for a couple of unsuspecting mugs from outside.
Couldn't I just stay on television?
Gerasimovich stammered.
Are you refusing?
Askolupov frowned in surprise. That angry look was never long absent from his features.
For what reason?
All the laws of the cruel prison world told Gerasimovich that taking pity on comfortable know-nothings, enjoying their freedom without a care in the world, was as eccentric as not killing pigs for fatback. The mugs outside did not have immortal souls. Zex earned them the hard way, serving their never-ending sentences. Outside, men used the liberty allowed them selfishly and stupidly, mired in their petty schemes and futile endeavours. But Natasha was his helpmate for life. She had been waiting while he served his second term. She was a feeble little thing, fading fast, and his own life would flicker out with hers.
"Do I need reasons?"
he answered in a faint voice.
"I just can't do it. I couldn't cope."
Yakonov, whose mind had been wandering, now looked closely at Gerasimovich. Another one determined to defy common sense, he thought. But the universal rule, look out for number one, would surely operate here, too. Askolupov tried persuasion.
You just aren't used to serious assignments anymore, so you're a bit afraid of them. But if you can't manage it, who can? All right, I'll let you think it over.
Gerasimovich rested his brow on his small hand and said nothing. After all, it wasn't the atom bomb. In the scale of world events, it was an imperceptibly minute detail.
But what is there to think about? This is just the sort of thing you've been trained to do.
Why not just keep quiet? Fool them. Take the job on, spin it out, get nothing done. But Gerasimovich rose, looked contemptuously at the barrel-bellied, flabby-cheeked, pig-faced degenerate wearing a general's hat, and said in a ringing voice,
"No, it isn't what I was trained to do. Putting people in prison isn't my trade. I am no fisher of men. It's enough that we've been imprisoned ourselves."